Appeal 11-1837, the United States versus James Simon. Good morning, Mr. Safer.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Ron Safer, and I represent Jim Simon before this Court. The District Court abused its discretion by excluding evidence central to Mr. Simon's defense, and with the Court's permission, I will start by addressing that issue. The defense theory was that money that Mr. Simon received from various entities was a loan from the partnership, which was the vast majority of the money from JAS Partners, was a loan or non-taxable distribution from the partnership. That is what he stated in opening statement to the jury. Mr. Simon regarded them as loans, but they reflected few of the factors that the jury has to consider in determining whether they are, in fact, a loan.
Did the court's order on the motion in limine exclude evidence about assets that Mr. Simon himself put into the partnership, or only other sources of income to the partnership? I'm trying to determine if trial counsel believed himself to be more constrained than he actually was. The order excludes evidence about loans to the partnership from, quote, anyone other than the Simons. And that wouldn't prevent him from putting on evidence that he personally invested $2 million in the partnership. Is that, am I right?
If he had, yes, you are right, Your Honor. If he had written a check to the partnership itself, then he would have been able to do that, introduce that. In fact, he did not. He wrote the check or, you know, contributed the money to the Simon Family Trust, which then is a partner in JAS Partners, and the judge excluded that evidence. So Mr. Simon, in effect, contributed the money to JAS Partners, but the order was unambiguous that Mr. Simon could not put that evidence in. And that is at page 643 to 645. The court made it very clear it was excluding that evidence. The $2 million contribution, which is the bulk of the money in the family trust, and exceeded all distributions that he received from it in the partnership. And that evidence was excluded, no question about it. Indeed, when Mr. Simon's counsel made his offer of proof that the family trust was funded by $2 million of after-tax dollars on page 627, the judge found that indeed that was excluded evidence. So the order was extremely broad.
See, it seems to me, well, not seems to me, I think this is, okay. The government concedes that this would be a legitimate defense. But argues that it was never made clear to the court what his defense was, and that he failed to produce enough evidence to be allowed to bring in the defense, right?
I think that's right, Your Honor.
Right. So,
but he made it very clear. In opening statement, he said at page 183 that the money received was from the partnership was a loan or a non-taxable distribution from the partnership. The court indeed took the extraordinary step of adjourning the trial.
That did not exceed his basis in the partnership.
Right. Well, that it was a non-taxable distribution from the partnership because it did not exceed its basis.
So that would be non-taxable. That's
yes.
The argument.
Exactly. And he made that right at the beginning of the trial. And the court adjourned the trial. And the court understood well the argument that defense counsel was making. He said it was late in the day, but he didn't bar it because of that. What he ultimately concluded was there wasn't enough in that he was excluding the evidence and the jury could not draw the conclusion. But that is just not so, Your Honor, and it impermissibly shifts the burden of proof. The tax code itself is valuable guidance. Section 731 says, in the case of a distribution by a partnership to a partner, gain shall not be recognized to such partner except to the extent that any money distributed exceeds the adjusted basis.
Now, earlier, when you noted pages 633 to 645 of the record, is that where Mr. Simon made this argument clear to the district court, or is that where the district court made clear to Mr. Simon that?
That's where the district court made clear to Mr. Simon. But as I say, the court took a day in the middle of trial to understand Mr. Simon's position. It was briefed in writing. The position was clear.
I was just going to say, if the court took all of that time, looked at all of the evidence, it's a matter of judge's discretion.
It is, Your Honor, but he abused his discretion. He understood the argument, but misunderstood the law, really, and misapplied the law. What he found was that Mr. Simon had to produce expert testimony that was going to say at the end of the day that there was here X was the basis, X dollars was the basis, and that without that computation, he was not going to allow any evidence. Well, that's an abuse of discretion.
So, in other words, okay, so I'm going to go to the record, and I'm going to try and figure out where Mr. Simon made this argument clear to the district court. So where do I go?
I will provide you before I come back, or when I come back, with the record citation of both the pleading that Mr. Simon filed during trial that made this clear and the pages where this is discussed at some length. Because, Judge Coleman, I agree 100%. It is committed to the discretion of the court. But when the court says that before I will allow you to put in evidence of this defense, you must have an expert testify that X is the amount of the basis, that was wrong. That was an abuse of discretion, and it precluded Mr. Simon from putting in his defense. All that was necessary.
Did he say he needed an expert, or did he say he hadn't presented enough foundation to present an expert?
Well, no. He was saying you have to have somebody compute the basis. And indeed, the offer of proof was made that Mr. Rickshafer, a tax attorney, would say that the basis exceeded distributions, so it would not be taxable or reportable income. But that was not sufficient for the judge, and that was an abuse of discretion. All that was necessary for Mr. Simon was to put in some evidence in support of his theory, and then the government has to prove, beyond any reasonable doubt, that the distribution did not exceed its basis. The court shifted that burden of proof in an unconstitutional and abusive discretion way. Mr. Rickshafer would have testified that Mr. Simon's basis exceeded the distributions, and thus those distributions would have been non-taxable income. The positive adjustments to the basis were more than double the amount distributed to him. And the government had all the information necessary to make the basis computation. They had all the books of the partnership, all of the bank accounts, but they did not make that basis computation. It was their burden of proof, not Mr. Simon's. Mr. Simon sought to put in evidence that the trust was funded by $2 million of after-tax dollars, that that money raised his basis in the partnership by $2 million. He sought to put in money of a loan from Dunn Willis, other loans, the sale of a residence, an inheritance, and the expert testimony that although he did not make the final calculation, that the basis exceeded distributions, so it would not be taxable, and he was precluded from putting all of that in. Thus, the case became only, was this a loan or wasn't it? And that was an abuse of discretion. The Supreme Court in Boulware made it very clear that whatever the taxpayer believed or did not believe the transaction would be, the court must look at the economic reality of the transaction. And thus, in that case, they said, we have to look at whether this is non-taxable distribution, even though there was no evidence that the taxpayer believed that that's what it was. And the district court simply did not do that. And that was an abuse of discretion. With regard to the FBAR filing, we are literally in the Kafkaesque situation where today Mr. Simon is not obliged to yet have filed an FBAR, and yet he was indicted.
Let me ask you, Mr. Safer, on the FBAR that he filed, did he attach an explanation as required?
He did not, Your Honor.
And so doesn't that mean that he wasn't entitled to the amnesty?
It does not, Your Honor. And it's not really the amnesty portion that he's entitled to. What he's entitled to is that the part that says you don't have to file this, two parts. Mm-hmm. It says, one, you don't have to file it for years 2009 and before. And that's what he was indicted for, not for filing an incomplete form. He was indicted for not filing.
How do we factor in the fact that he was already under investigation by the time he filed his late FBARs?
Not at all, Your Honor, because he was under no obligation to file it. So it's not the situation, for example, where a taxpayer is accused of not having recorded certain income and then is under investigation, and then amends his tax return. That's a different situation. In that situation, you have to factor it in very heavily because it bears on intent. Here, it's a different situation. Here, he was not obligated to file the FBAR at all. And the second part of that is in counts 1 through 4, the government indicted Mr. Simon for a false tax return in part because he did not file a Schedule B that says if you have signature authority, please, over this account, please check, file Section B and check yes. The IRS later tells taxpayers not only do you not have to file an FBAR, but if for some other reason you're filing a Schedule B, check no. He is indicted for not having checked yes at a time when the IRS is telling taxpayers, if you file this, check no. That is anathema to our criminal justice system. To tell a taxpayer, this is what you must do or what you should do, and then indict them because they did exactly that, is Kafkaesque. It should not be tolerated in our system. Any of those errors requires a new trial in total. whether you find that he was precluded from putting in the evidence of his defense in an abuse of discretion, or whether the FBAR count should not have been brought, should have been dismissed, that requires a new trial under Yates, because the government has not come close to bearing its harmless error burden of saying that proving beyond a reasonable doubt that the jurors would have found Mr. Simon guilty.
Mr. Safer, was there ever evidence? Did the defense ever tender an instruction or request an instruction about the taxability of partnerships?
It did, Your Honor. It did it during the trial, and the district court found that it was time barred because it required instructions to be submitted pre-trial.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Will you please add 3 minutes to Mr. Holler's time, because Mr. Safer used his time, but we're going to give him 3 minutes for a rebuttal. Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You have 18 minutes.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I'm happy for all the time that you're willing to give me. I guess I would propose to go in the order that the defendant had initially put in his brief, which is to start with the FBAR issue. The Internal Revenue Service's 2009 and 2010 notices, which extended the FBAR filing deadlines and waived civil penalties under certain circumstances, did not operate to provide criminal amnesty for the defendant's already completed federal crimes. It is Congress which creates crimes, and only Congress can forgive a completed violation. In this case, the IRS offered civil relief, and if one looks at the notices that are provided, beginning first with the Q&A on the website, it's clear that that is only discussing civil relief. It talks specifically at the beginning of that May 6, 2009 guidance on addendum page 21 about how the IRS can be imposing potentially onerous civil penalties for unknowing FBAR violations. It also notices that by coming forward and participating in the program, someone will generally eliminate, in question 3, or minimize the chances of criminal prosecution, in question 4.
And, counsel, the one question, the concern that the court has is, you know, you put out this program, you say come forward, you minimize your chances for penalties, and then on the other side you hit them with a criminal case saying we're totally different. I mean, isn't it sort of dangling a treat out there, and then someone comes to get it, and then you say, oh, we've got you?
Well, I think there's two answers to that, Your Honor. First point that I would make out is that the answer is no. Under the voluntary disclosure program and under the Crystal case and the other cases that are cited in many cases, it has long been noted that the fact and the existence of a voluntary disclosure program gives the defendant no entitlement to freedom from criminal prosecution. The IRS's decision to offer civil relief does not offer for individuals does not offer relief for those who knowingly and willfully violated the law. The second point that I think it's important to keep in mind is that all of Mr. Simon's violations occurred in years long prior to this May 6, 2000 notice and any of the follow-up notices. The last thing that he was charged with was failing to file an FBAR on June 30th of 2008, and all of the other violations were before that. So for that reason, none of this had any bearing on any of his intent, and the defendant has conceded the sufficiency of the evidence on the FBAR counts, raising only this legal claim. So in question 9, when they say the IRS will not impose a penalty for failure to file FBARs, again, it's clear that what they are talking about is civil relief. And nothing in any of the other notices makes any change to that. The 2009 notice specifically says it is supplementing the Q&As, and it is supplementing the Q&As for persons with no financial interest in a foreign financial account but with signature or other authority, and that those individuals this supplements the filing extension to September 23rd, 2009, previously provided by the IRS. That's on addendum page 15. And then the 2010 notice, again, is just a supplemental notice to that. So none of this can be inferred to provide any relief from criminal penalties.
So, in other words, that's what you're saying are the limitations to the voluntary disclosure program? Is that what you're saying?
Well, the limitations to the voluntary disclosure program, Your Honor, are that it only applies to civil relief. None of it applies to criminal relief. The IRS manual makes that clear. None of it has ever applied to criminal relief. But, Judge Rovner, even if one...
Where does it make it clear? Could you give me some pages?
First of all, it's only talking about civil penalties on addendum page 21. In response to question 1, in question 3, in question 4. So all of those make that clear. Additionally, we've cited to the Internal Revenue Manual itself, Internal Revenue Manual 9.5.11.9, section 2, which is cited to in our brief, states, quote, a voluntary disclosure will not automatically guarantee immunity from prosecution. Furthermore, section 4 notes that a disclosure is untimely if it is received after the IRS has already initiated a civil examination or criminal investigation. And in this case, it's clear from the record, the search warrants in this case were conducted in 2007. So the case had already been referred from the Treasury Department to the Justice Department at that time. So none of this can apply. But even if one thought that this was somehow what the IRS was trying to do, the administrative law cases that we have cited make it clear that an agency cannot provide that kind of retroactive relief, or at minimum cannot do so absent a clear statement. Congress cannot, absent a clear statement of retroactive intent, even attempt to do that, and the executive branch cannot do that either. So as Hark points out, it is the statute, not the regulation, that creates the offense and imposes a punishment for its violation. The agency, by promulgating rules long prior to 2006, 7, and 8, imposed, triggered the offense. The offense was then committed. And nothing that the agency does after that, that the Treasury Department or that the IRS does after that, can excuse that committed federal crime. Congress could repeal Section 5322 or amend it retroactively if it wanted to, but the agency cannot do so. Neither the executive branch nor Congress has delegated to the Treasury or to the IRS the power to enforce criminal statutes or grant clemency. That's also made clear through the statutory structure. If you look at 31 U.S.C. Section 5322 is the criminal provision. That makes certain things a crime. 31 U.S.C. Section 5321, the section before that, sets up a scheme of civil penalties and delegates to the Treasury Department the power to enforce those penalties. So everything that's being discussed in every notice that is cited by the defendant is talking about Section 5321. It's talking about civil penalties. And when a defendant has already, prior to any of these administrative notices, committed a federal crime, nothing that that agency does has any effect on the criminal enforcement scheme.
Isn't there a real distinction between HARC and this case, though? And HARC is an expired regulation. Here, this is a proactive program.
Well, it's a proactive program, but there's nothing in here that that indicates any intent by the IRS to get involved in retroactive criminal regulation. And I do agree that HARC was clearly prospective. I suppose the case that is most on point of those old Supreme Court cases is the Curtis Wright decision. In that particular case, the Congress said if the president proclaims that the situation in Bolivia is such that arms dealing with those nations should not be permitted, it's a crime, as long as the president says that it's a crime. And the president said for a period of time it's a crime, issued a proclamation, and then issued another proclamation with a savings clause that said all prosecutions that are currently pending are saved. And what happened? A few months later, we indicted someone else. And the defendant said, well, the savings clause only saved people who were already indicted, so it must mean that it doesn't apply to me. And the Supreme Court was clear, no, the president doesn't have the power to do that. Congress has already made it a crime. The president can, through triggering actions, decide whether it's a crime during this period of time or not. But once the crime has been committed, it's an offense against Congress. It's an offense against the laws of the United States.
We've got a first impression here, don't we?
Well, you have a little bit of first impression, Your Honor, but I believe it's dictated to some extent by the prior cases.
Well, I mean, whether the IRS and Treasury could retroactively render a violation null if the extensions never applied to him in any case.
Right. Well, if the extensions never applied to him in any case, then the IRS didn't try to do that. But if if you accept his argument that that is what the IRS was trying to do, then yes, this would be the first court that would say that an agency has the breathtaking power to essentially go back and retroactively annul a completed criminal violation. I mean, obviously, this court is well aware from the FSA cases, from Fisher and all that, of the difficulty with which it is to even retroactively have Congress go back and retroactively amend a criminal statute, and the clear statement that needs to be made for Congress to do that. To suggest that an agency, through an even less clear process, could go back and undo a completed criminal violation, that would be a matter of first impression and would be a pretty breathtaking step for this court to take. I would like to talk about the second issue as well, Your Honors. So turning to the evidentiary ruling issue, Your Honor, I think that Your Honors are correct. Judge Miller did not abuse his discretion in the ruling that he made. And Judge Roedner, you may be correct that there were some questions about the contours of exactly what was or was not included, but I think that the court should keep in mind, if one reviews the transcript closely, a great deal of evidence was admitted in this case about the Simon Family Trust. A great deal of evidence was admitted in this case about funds, about loans, and about all of this particular information that was coming into play. But what the district court was not going to let the defendant do was to come in at the last minute and essentially say, when through motions in limine and through pretrial practice, this is a loans case, I'm not really seeking to admit any of this information except on a loans theory. Now I want to bring it in on a whole different theory that I've never disclosed and acknowledged before.
Was it really a different theory?
Yes, it's a different theory, Your Honor, yes. The defendant had, in his tax returns, filed and said these are loans. The defendant, in all of his pretrial representations and all of his meetings, had said these are loans. These are loans. These are loans. We filed a pretrial motion that said we're not seeking to exclude evidence of these loans, but unrelated loans to other entities that may or may not be legitimate are not going to have any relevance on whether or not these loans are shams. The defense in response, in its response to that motion, to the motion in limine that eventually triggered all this, said, Your Honor, we concede, you know, we're presenting this as a loans case, and we concede that this isn't really relevant, but it shows some evidence of intent. A bunch of things that have essentially dropped out of this particular case. And then in the morning of trial, the defense shows up and says, here's my theory, Your Honor. My theory is, yes, Mr. Simon thought these were loans. Yes, that's going to be hard for us to prove in this case. So what we're going to prove instead is, if we recharacterize this whole tax returns, and if we bring in somebody else, which, by the way, we're not going to really bring anybody else in to do that, but potentially if we brought in somebody else, they could recharacterize all of this, and we could prove that there weren't any false statements on the tax return because he didn't owe any tax because these were distributions. Well, that's what they wanted to prove.
See, what I'm trying to figure out is, what evidence does he need to make this defense? I understand your point that he didn't document loans to the partnership, but that goes to the weight of the evidence, not its admissibility. In other words, why couldn't the government just point out in cross-examination that the loans were likely shams because there was no documentation? That gives them the benefit of the defense. And the jury can then decide if undocumented loans are shams or not. I'm troubled by any suggestion that expert testimony was required.
I don't think that expert testimony was necessarily required, but in this case, Judge Roedner, expert testimony was not even essentially offered. Jury instructions were not offered at the time that this whole motion was being aired out. Jury instructions had not been offered. Jury instructions were not suggested at the time the motion in limine was granted. And what I don't think a defendant can do is essentially introduce a whole bunch of evidence and say, well, we don't really know whether this has any relevance to basis or not, but it kind of muddles things up enough that you should essentially find that the government hasn't met its burden of proof. Then all you're really doing is admitting a bunch of irrelevant evidence that can't prove the proposition that you're making. If the defendant can't come up with some argument to the jury that could give them some rational basis to believe that he had basis that would allow him then to do this as a distribution, then he can't possibly prove that there's no tax.
Look, there's a list on the bottom of page 18 of your brief of evidence that Mr. Simon wanted to present to establish his basis in the partnership. What, if any, of that would have been admissible under the court's order on the motion to eliminate? And is the problem that none of it came from Simon personally, but rather from the related entities? Is that it?
The only one that I would concede would have to be excluded would be B, money loaned on a promissory note by somebody else, because that's a loan. The transfer of assets, inheritance of money, sale of a home, it's not clear whether that would or would not be. And it's not 100% clear to me that loans from the Simon Family Trust to JAS Partners were excluded by this order. But even to the extent that they were, Your Honor, his claim essentially is that there were these loans that occurred that increased his basis. And I guess that there are two points that we have pointed out, which is, again, even if the court thinks that there is an abuse of discretion here, there is absolutely no doubt that this error was harmless. And there are essentially two reasons for that. The first is that if this all had come in, then the government would have been coming in to essentially establish what we already did, which is if the jury believes that these loans from Jazz Partners to Simon are shams, then why are they not going to believe that loans from the Simon Trust, which is also Simon, to Jazz Partners are shams? In addition to which, as was testified to at the sentencing hearing by the IRS, if an entire partnership, I mean, this partnership is essentially appears to be just a tax shelter, just a way to attempt to exclude basis, and under those circumstances, we're entitled to disregard the form of the partnership. My second point would be, even if we leave all that aside, there is still almost $700,000 in income that came from the Elekta entities that the defendant just wants to ignore. Okay, there were two sources of loans, quote-unquote loans, that were being given to Mr. Simon. The partner's evidence, the JAS partner's evidence, which is what they want to discuss, and the Elekta loans, money that was loaned directly from these Elekta entities, these foreign companies, to Mr. Simon. Mr. Simon's partnership theory, this theory that the partnership distributions are not loans, has zero application to all of this money, the $663,000 that was loaned from the Elekta entities. Additional evidence of his theory that these were sham loans but they can be recharacterized as distributions would have, if anything, reinforced the fact that these were all sham loans, which means that the money that's coming from the foreign companies is also a sham loan. So whatever one thought about the partnership evidence, there is no defense, and the defendants essentially ignore that. In their opening brief, they argue, well, maybe these could have been viewed as loan repayments. We demonstrated in our response that no, in fact, Sherry Simon, the sister, stated, no, we owed Simon money. He wasn't repaying anything in loans. So there's no defense. There's no defense for $663,000 worth of money coming in, and there is no reason to believe that the jury, having heard a whole bunch of additional evidence that's going to only support a theory that the partnership loans are a sham, is going to be somehow likely to believe anything other than that the rest of this money is a sham and therefore is income. So he still would be unable to prevail on his case.
Suppose the jury had believed the partnership theory. Do you still have a viable harmless error argument?
Absolutely, Your Honor. If it had accepted this partnership theory,
yeah.
If it had accepted the theory, the theory is, this is the defendant's argument. All of this was a sham. All of the loans were a sham. I can take all of the partnership evidence and I can recharacterize all of it, and then I don't have income coming in from the partnership. That's his theory. Okay? That does nothing to explain the money coming in from the foreign companies, from Elekta and from JS Elekta. None. It can't explain that at all. So if it can't explain that at all, and if in fact more evidence about a theory his theory that these are distributions is only triggered if the jury first finds that the loans are a sham. If the loans are not a sham, there's no need to recharacterize the tax return and make it a distribution. None. So he would be putting in, essentially, jury instructions, theories, experts, predicated on the theory that the loans from the partnership are a sham. And, I mean, there can't be any argument that, that the fact that the loans from the partnership are a sham makes it more likely that the loans from the Elekta entities are not. These are all interrelated companies. These are foreign. I mean, the Elekta entities are essentially him being set up in corporate form to avoid him being an employee. And the partnership is a way to shelter his assets. So none of this could possibly have mattered. We did go through in our brief, and I see that I'm out of time, and explain if the court were to have issues with Issue 1 or Issue 2, why that doesn't require reversal of certain counts, and why no matter what, the fraud counts, which are predicated essentially on the falsifying of his expenses and of his lavish lifestyle to these schools, would not justify reversal of those counts as well. I see that I'm out of time, and I'm content to rest on my brief on that, unless the court has questions about how we've worked through that. I thank the court for the extra time.
Thank you very much. You're going to have to add another minute, so 4 minutes now.
Oh. Your Honors, the theory was not at all that all these loans were shams. So, Judge Ripple, your question has not been answered. That was not the theory. The theory was he believed that these were loans. He intended to repay them. He did repay them. But he understood, or his counsel did, that when you look at the factors of what a jury must find to find that there was a loan, that there weren't a lot of them there. And thus, under Boulware, on the Supreme Court teaching says, you have to look at the economic reality. And if you look at the economic reality, if they were not loans, then they were a distribution for partnership, and there was sufficient basis. So the Elekta defense that the jury rejected, the Elekta defense, or would have, that those were valid loans is not clear at all, because there was testimony from Mr. Simon's sister that he had borrowed money from Elekta and that she knew about that. Thus, the theory is not that all loans were a sham. Your Honor, the pleading is document number 114 that sets forth all of these arguments. Some of the argument, the key pages, are at 623 to 29 and 636 to 65. At the end of that, at 665, the court says, my understanding of the order in limine and what we talked about yesterday and today is that where the entities got the money that were transferred to Mr. Simon is irrelevant. Again, I know we keep going back to that. I think we need to move on in order to get to the next step. How the partnership got the money under my order, as I understand the law and the party's argument at this point, how whatever the entity is from which Mr. Simon got these monies is not relevant and is covered by the order in limine. For the government to stand here and say to you it's not clear that these things that they list in their brief was excluded is disingenuous, because there was an offer of proof made at the end, during this, where the defense said, here is what I would have put in if you had allowed me to. It was on page 627 that it was funded with, that the partnership was funded with $2 million of after-tax dollars from the family trust, the Don Willis loan, the Schuerman loan, the sale of the residence, the inheritance. The latter is at 655 and 656. The court didn't say, oh, you're misunderstanding my ruling. You can get some of that in. The government didn't say, oh, you aren't barred from it, putting that evidence. He was barred from putting all of that evidence in. Now, what the government stood before you and just said was there has to be some rational basis to believe that he had basis sufficient to cover these distributions. That standard was much more than met. The basis increased by more than $3 million in the evidence that was excluded. The distributions were only $1 million. That is more than is required under the law. A moment on the FBARs. The government is conflating two programs. There is a voluntary disclosure practice that, if you look at the question and answers that he was reading to you, involves people who did not report taxable income in the past to voluntarily come forward and resolve the tax matters. That's not this. This is filing an FBAR report. It's not the taxable income. It's not the voluntary disclosure. And the 2009 notice says that it is, if you have signature authority only, do not file. It is not a repealing a statute. The statute tells the secretary to say what people have to do. The secretary says you don't have to do it. He's then prosecuting for not doing it. That is a case of first impression, and this court should say we don't do that in the United States of America. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Safer. Thank you, Mr. Holler. The case will be taken under advisement.